I heard they're kind of kicking it again. Heard they finally got some discipline. Running up the score. That's the hold steady. I'm Blake Murphy, and this is Jays Talk Plus. The Jays didn't exactly run up the score, but for the first time in 21 games, they did put a 6 on the board, scoring 6 or more runs for the first time after a franchise record-tying 20-game drought. And as it turns out, that's really helpful to winning baseball games. They needed it with a short Yariel Rodriguez start, giving way to a shorthanded bullpen day. Bit of a nail-biter, 6-5 victory against the Royals. So yes, the somewhat arbitrary stat is done. The six runs are, or the fewer than six runs streak is over. Worth noting still, though, that the Jays are 1-11 when they give up 5 or more runs. They are 11-1 when they score 5 or more. So as arbitrary as it sometimes seems, that does seem to be the magic number for a very pitching and defense first team. A very, very fun game. Not only was there offense, there was a first career hit. There was a second career save. We're going to get into all of it. We're going to talk to Mike Petriello of MLB.com in the second half of our show today. We're going to tee up Jose Berríos, Cole Ragans rematch that I promise won't be rained out this time because it's at Rogers Center where we have a domed roof. And we're going to talk to Caleb Joseph, Sportsnet analyst, Blue Jays Central analyst, and all-around good guy who joins us because it's too rainy out to golf. Caleb, good morning, man. How you doing?
What's up, Blake? What's up, man?
So you were going to golf this morning if you didn't come on with us. Who's the best golfer? Like, when you're in Toronto, and I assume you're going out with some people, you know, around the team, around Toronto media, who's the sharp there? Like, who are you gunning for?
Oh, wow. Well, I've heard Buck Martinez is an excellent golfer. I've played with Whit Merrifield. He's obviously moved on. He was a good one. And I've heard Ernie Clement is fantastic. So I'm trying to set up a game with Ernie Clement, maybe even Jordan Romano, and would love to get Justin Turner out there and have a round. So we'll see. Hopefully it works out.
I have heard the same about Ernie. I think he's maybe, you know, unless a new guy is better than we've heard, I think that's probably the guy to beat there, which makes sense. You know, you got the bat to ball skill, you got the good hands in the infield.
Exactly.
That's a golfer's skill set, right?
Exactly. Not surprised one bit. He probably just gets up there, doesn't even think about it. It's at 295 down the middle every time.
Perfect, which I'm sure you do as well, right? Nothing but fairways and greens.
Yeah, right to my 85 every round.
Caleb, you mentioned Justin Turner there. So Jays win last night. They get 6 runs. That little streak is off their back now. And Justin Turner with another big game for the Blue Jays. Obviously, this is a guy who brings a lot to this team beyond just the bat. But for a guy who is, until Joey Votto gets back, if he gets back at any point, the oldest player in the league, for him to be doing what he's doing for the Blue Jays early on here, hitting 311, 923 OPS, second on the team in home runs. What are you seeing from Justin Turner in the early going here?
Veteran approach. It's pretty simple. And I thought yesterday's game was a perfect example of just a veteran player, a guy who's been around for a long time, just taking a few young kids to school. You got a younger catcher back there. You got a younger pitcher with not a ton of experience. You got an older player that's been around the block, seeing just about every sequence and combination. He gets to a first pitch, he gets to a hang and breaking ball in the first at bat. And I'll tell you, he said after the post game with Arden that he didn't know how he hit that ball up and in. And I can tell you right now, I guarantee you that he was looking that up and in quadrant, because any veteran hitter is going to look hard in after you kind of do some damage on a soft away. It was one of those Turner's playing chess out there and just had that pitcher and that catcher right where he wanted them. And I remember being teammates with Seager in 2021 in Seattle with Kyle Seager. And I asked him, because he hit like 32 home runs or something, drove in 100-plus runs batted in age 34, 35 season. He retired after that year. And I said, how are you doing this, man? You're getting older. This is your 10th year. How are you doing this? He said, hitting's never been easier for someone who actually has been around, because the game is so predictable now. It's just all about knowing who's catching and pitching and knowing if they're going to go to your strength or your weakness and then just trying to hit it. So I think Turner's figured that out, that he's got a really refined game plan. He knows exactly what they're probably going to do to him. there's no guessing involved, then it's just a matter of him beating it to the spot and getting that result.
Oh, that's some great insight on, you know, the young battery there, right? Young pitcher, young catcher, and especially a guy just up to the majors, fresh from the minors. You know, they're I'd assume in that case, Caleb, and Fermin is on the younger end as a catcher, but even as a vet catcher, a guy first game up from AAA, are you probably trying to like simplify thing and play to his strengths rather than getting too cutesy up there?
Oh yeah, that is the number one goal for a guy that's early on making his debut or just the first couple starts in the big leagues. You're trying to keep it as simple as possible. You're not trying to throw too much at him, ask him to do too much too quickly. You know his strengths. You're probably going to try and stay with those strengths. And that is it. That's what you're trying to do. I've just found it so interesting that Hank Aaron, you know, he said one of the hardest things about baseball is knowing what that hitter knowing what that pitcher is trying to do to you. And that's 80% of hitting, he said. And if you can figure out exactly how they're going to attack you, you're going to have a chance. And I thought that was exactly kind of what Turner did. And on the flip side, like you said, when you're a catcher trying to get a guy going, that's the cat and mouse game that you're trying to play. And I think when you put a veteran up there, you're playing chess. When you've got kind of a younger squad, it's more or less about, here's my stuff. I know what you've got. It's kind of stuff on stuff. But with the older player, you're more or less trying to play a strategy game because you know he's seen it all. Even though you've got a good breaking ball or a good fastball, you're going to have to locate it and switch up the counts and switch up the sequences.
So Turner, a lot of the offense early from the very veteran side of the team. And then to get that sixth run in the sixth inning, the Jays get a big contribution from the exact opposite end, a rookie fresh from the minors, 24-year-old Addison Barger. He gets his first major league hit. He takes a liner from Sauer, 106 miles an hour off the bat, which is what Addison Barger does here. Lines one into right center field, holds up, decides not to take second on that single, then eventually scores on a Vladimir Guerrero Jr. Double. What have you liked or what have you been looking at with Barger since he's come up? Not the best surface level numbers, but he hits the heck out of the ball.
Yeah, you can't argue with his aggressiveness, and it is it looks to be like a collision type of bat, collision type of swing. And I've played with a lot of players and seen a lot of players make a lot of money with a collision type swing. What I mean by that is it's a hard swing and it's in a general vicinity. And if they throw it in that general vicinity, it's going to come off with some hot exit velo numbers. And that's what he did last night for his first major league hit. And I remember my first major league hit like it was yesterday. It's a moment that he'll never forget. I really love that it was at home. I feel like there's something special about getting your first major league hit at home. The fans can really get into it. You could tell the way he was running to first base that he was taking three on a sure single. Like, his legs were flying. He probably had no idea what planet he was on there for a second. But I thought that was actually a really pivotal play in the game that he decided to hold up. That's actually a really, really smart play in the heat of what might be his biggest moment on a Major League Baseball field, because that one run that you just alluded to, that was Barger's run off of the bat of Vladdy Guerrero Jr., that was huge in a 6-5 victory for the Jays. So in the moment, I think he made a perfect decision. It played out well. But yeah, when it comes to his actual swing, I'm paying attention because I know there's so much power there that if he gets it and it's got the right launch, I think it's going to get out of the ballpark. So it's one of those swings that kind of captivates you because it does look full effort, high octane type of speed. And hopefully after getting this first major league hit, he can settle in and get many more.
You mentioned you remember your first major league hit. Well, I know you told the story on Blue Jays Central last night, but for anyone who didn't catch that, it's you against Drew Smyly. You are at home in Baltimore in your rookie year. What do you remember about that plate appearance?
Yeah, I remember feeling like I hit it right off my right index finger. it wasn't that bad. I told Jamie Campbell, I said it was a nine hopper up the middle. I have no idea how nobody caught it. And we watched it last night for fun, and it wasn't too bad, but I remember it being kind of like a high high kind of cut fastball. You know, he threw the ball up in the zone, but I think he pulled it a little bit, and it was a little bit over the belt, and I just kind of muscled it right through the middle of the infield. And I remember hitting first base and just exhaling, thinking, okay, I am officially in the books. This is very good. I think I was 0 for 8 before I got that hit. It was at home. The fans were amazing. I got the ball. It's a moment I'll never forget.
So you get the ball. I know the first home run always gets reacted to with the silent treatment in the dugout. Is there any sort of treatment from the guys for first hit, or that's withheld for the first time you go yard?
Yeah, great question. I don't think I've ever silenced the guy on a first hit. I think it's always the home run. I think the first hit is actually the opposite. I think dudes are running over. Even pitchers are like, hey, man, congrats. Isn't it funny? If you're going to get them for their first homer, you should get them for their first hit, too. That'd be great. The guy's over there super excited about his first hit, and nobody is saying anything to him. And I thought it was pretty cool last night watching Turner and Barger interaction. That was great camera work by Sportsnet, and it was fun to watch their interaction after his first hit. Really, really cool stuff. That's what baseball is all about, and it's fun to see kind of those firsts and milestones in the game.
So Barger ends up scoring in that inning on a Vladimir Guerrero Jr. double. Vlad had a pretty aggressive night, put the ball in play well, came up with two hits. That one, a sinker that is on the inner part of the plate, right on the edge there, mm-hmm. and he hammers it for a double. Is that the kind of swing you've been waiting on from Vladimir Guerrero Jr.?
Yeah, that's what it looks like. It looks like a line drive. It looks like a ball that is headed directionally towards left center. And the fact that he got to velocity, 95, 96 miles an hour, and it was located. It wasn't just a mm-hmm. center cut heater. The fact that he got to it, hit it 116 or something off the bat, it was an absolute missile. I liked it. I do think that when he's going really well, there's this stability in his finish. And just the way the swing looks like it's swinging a little bit more in slow motion when he's really, really on. I feel like I can still, even last night, I like the swings. He got good results. He hit the barrel. It does look like there's more effort there, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And if that's what it's going to look like from here on out and he gets results, I care less. Like, go ahead, man. But I'm looking for those results with a just kind of a smoother, more effortless looking swing, and that's when I really think he's going well. That'll tell me he's really using the ground and using his lower half. But I'm not going to be the one to sit here and complain about results. I mean, the fact that he hit two balls over 100 miles an hour, they were on a line, it looked visually like Vladdy getting going. That is very good. And sometimes you get to a point as a player where it's just, you know, enough's enough. And I think the aggressive hacks are kind of those, I have nothing to lose. Screw it. Like, let's go out there, swing hard in case I hit it. And sure enough, he blistered two balls yesterday. Good sign.
Yeah, hopefully he can build on that today and the rest of the series gets a little bit of momentum here. The other part of the offense I skipped over, Danny Jansen hit a home run on Danny Jansen giveaway day, which is a nice piece of work. I was looking at the Blue Jays all-time home run leaderboard among catchers today. Ernie Witt, of course, way out in front with 131. But Jano passed Russell Martin with his 67th for second all-time on that Blue Jays catcher home run list. Caleb Joseph, you're on there. Do you remember the home run you hit as a Blue Jay?
Yes, Fenway Park. my last hit as a major leaguer was as a Blue Jay, that home run at Fenway Park.
Off of Andrew Triggs.
My dead last with one.
Well, not dead last. There are guys who've had zero.
I guess you're right. I'm on the list. On it, yes.
You're on the list. And then look, most of those other catchers didn't become terrific analysts on Blue Jays Central or Jays Talk Plus. So you got that in your favor as well. With Jansen, we've seen a lot from this catching duo the last couple of games. Alejandro Kirk had a very big Sunday. Jansen had a very big Monday. Our pal Chris Black had a thread this morning on Twitter that kind of went into, yeah. Hey, when you have both of these guys, and we know the catcher position is very physically demanding. There's a big, you know, mental tax to prepping for the game and prepping your pitchers, et cetera. How much more confident are you in each of these guys individually now that the Jays have them both healthy and can split up the playing time?
Yeah, you look at what they did, what was it, a couple of years ago where that tandem was basically the number one tandem in baseball, offensively speaking. Their numbers combined, elite. And I really feel like that's what the Blue Jays are banking on when they talk about the core, when they talk about getting the offense going. It's so easy for us to really hone in on Bichette, Guerrero, Springer, but you know, this combination of a very healthy Kirk, a very healthy Jansen, both hitting their stride, doing things offensively, that was a massive boost to the Blue Jays a couple of years ago, and even last year as well. These guys can come in and they can pick up that slack, and it's usually right in the middle of the order. It's kind of in that 5, 6, 7 spot where there are RBI opportunities, and we went over it last year quite a bit with Jansen. Most of his RBIs last year alone were either game tying or putting the Blue Jays ahead in a game. You talk about a clutch stat. He just finds ways to get big time runs batted in. And then when Kirk stands to right center field, how good of a hitter does he look? And it starts to open up a lot of different things. But him going Oppo Taco is exactly what you want to see. The swing did look more grounded. When these guys do what they do, it starts to take the eyes off of the big three and four up top. Now you start having a little bit more balance. Everything starts to fall into place. But them doing what they're doing, if they can continue hitting the ball like they are, big things are in store for this lineup.
Yeah, and you have to hope that kind of one guy feeds the other. There's a little bit of competition. Everyone's a little fresher because you're not playing. You know, Kirk played, what, 14 out of 17 games to start the season. You spent a couple seasons kind of in a split-time role. Did you feel better at the plate when you were not, you know, when you had a day off, when you were in a split-time role versus if you had to start 2, 3, 4 games in a row?
Yeah, it totally depended on who Matt Wieters didn't want to face. So if I had like Verlander and Scherzer, then you make a great point. I do remember there's a difference. There's three different types, right? There's everyday guys. There's kind of the 50-50 guys. And then there's your two times a week guy. And I've kind of been all three of those in my career. And I would say mentally and physically, I probably felt best being the 50-50 guy because it's just such a physically demanding position and mentally demanding. People don't realize how mentally drained you should be as a catcher after you call a big league game. And I just feel like when they have that healthy competition like you're talking about, and it does kind of get really close to a 60-40, 50-50, 65-35 type of split, they're really hitting those beautiful blends of what they both can bring, yet keep them both very, very fresh for what it takes to output what they want to output. And I remember being back there and having days where you're thinking, man, as an everyday guy, I'd like a day off here, but I know this is my job. And then being in that 50-50 role, you kind of get into the flow of a playing time too. And so then you could mentally start to prepare days ahead because you know Jano's got this game, I got that game, Kirk's got this game, I got that game, and it starts to really flow and ebb with the season. So, yep, I think that's the way the game in that position is changing. There's not really many guys that are pumping out 135 games behind the catcher position, so they're realizing when they can split it up, they can actually achieve more together as one individual just out there grinding.
So Caleb, that's the offensive side. We talked a little bit about, you know, the Freddie Fermin, Jonathan Boland dynamic went on the Royal side. You're Danny Jansen last night, and for the ninth inning in a very tight game, Nate Pearson comes in for the save. Now he's almost 28 years old. This is his fourth time getting a cup of coffee in the majors, but he'd only had the ninth inning in a close game once before in his career. Are you thinking anything different? Are you changing anything if you're Danny Jansen? Are you just saying, hey, Nate, you got the big fastball, you got the big curveball, make him hit it?
Yeah, I thought Danny did an amazing job. And what I would love to know is what part of kind of the sequencing that Pearson used was due to just matchups, or if he just went in there and said, you know what, I'm using my big fastball and I'm going to set that as the tone. And I'm going to establish that, and then I'm going to work off of that, because that's what it looked like. It looked like he went in there, and he had one thing on his mind, which was established fastball. And he gave up an early hit on a fastball, and he didn't shy away from it. That was so impressive to me that a couple of years ago, even last year, Nate Pearson might have just went to straight breaking balls. As soon as he gave up the hit off the fastball, he might have tried to throw 70% breaking balls, or he might have tried to ramp up and throw 105 miles an hour. But he stayed within his delivery. He had excellent location. Yeah, he gave up another hit on a slider, which wasn't a bad pitch to Salvador Perez. And now before he knows it, he's kind of boxed in. He's first and third, two outs, tying run at third in a one-run game. And he didn't panic. I felt like his demeanor, he might have been going crazy on the inside, but externally, I couldn't see anything. And that was a really huge part of his development, and just watching him stay within and have success, stay with the heater. I thought that last at bat was absolutely perfectly called by Daniel Jansen. They went to the fastball, four fastballs in a row, had a breaking ball that was fouled off, and he was too close to that breaking ball for me. They went back to the heater, which is exactly what I was thinking, fouled it off, and then I turned to Jamie Campbell and I said, hey, if he has a chase breaking ball here, he's good. And this is just pure execution. Can you get it below the zone? And right after I said that, he threw a beautiful chase breaking ball, back footish. Danny Jansen slides over, gets the ball. And I'm telling you, that was just a great way to finish an exciting game that was back and forth and back and forth. Got to give the Royals credit, too. They didn't give up. But that last inning, and specifically that last batter with Pearson, so impressive just how he did the whole thing. I think we're going to highlight it on Blue Jays Central before the game, because it had me pumped up. I was so happy for him and the Jays. That was a big moment.
Yeah, and it was such a great pitch. And if anyone is ever curious, when you see, you know, Chris Black or us mentioning on Blue Jay Central the blocking metrics or whatever, great job by Danny Jansen to make sure that one stays a strike three there. And for anyone who doesn't know, so I've gotten to sit in the booth with Caleb when you were doing radio games with Ben Wagner a couple seasons ago. You know, the odd time I'd do Jay's talk and then I'd stick around in the booth with you guys for the game. And the amount of times you would just like signal over to me with your hands what pitch was coming. It's very, very cool. So the fact that you and Danny called that one the same way is pretty cool to hear. That's something that obviously, you know, relievers are volatile, but you have to hope that Nate Pearson can build on from there. Last one before I let you go here, Caleb, we're going to see Cole Ragans for the second time in a week. He is a very hard throwing lefty. Like, he's Kikuchi-ish with that 96, sometimes even 97 fastball from the left side. Is there a benefit to seeing a guy like that twice in a short span here, or is it just too tough to get used to that kind of velocity from a lefty?
No, I think it matters in this case probably more than anything, because it's such a unique look, because it's something that you don't see every day. I think being able to get out there and see it again right away is a huge advantage for the Blue Jays. I feel like those guys, the deception that they have, that unique look is what kind of helps and gives them a little bit of a leg up, which is why I thought last night's start with Rodriguez would be tough. It would be a nice test for him in that the stuff is good. I really love the stuff, but how is he going to respond in back-to-back starts versus a pretty pesky Royals team? And I think that can work in favor of a pitcher sometimes, but When you're talking about the Jays in this matchup, I just love the fact that they've seen it and it's fresh on the mind. They know that they've got to get it going. They're going to remember right out of the gate, well, when he makes his move, I need to be breaking at the knee all the way to the top versus the leg already going down. Certain timing issues that you have, they're very, very fresh. And so you can go out there and make a very quick adjustment. Would love to see the Blue Jays jump on him really, really quick. They went to the bullpen very early as well last night. So this is going to be – this game right here might determine what happens in the finale. Whoever can get to the bullpen the quickest, try and use some of those resources that are remaining down there. It might set up even the third game with how that's played out. But jump on him quick. Get ready for that heater. Stay on the heater and jump on him quick would be my approach if I was a Jay tonight.
Well, let's hope we see it. Caleb, looking forward to seeing you down at the ballpark. Thanks for taking the time out this morning, man.
Yep, you got it. See you, Blake.
Caleb Joseph, analyst on Blue Jay Central. He'll continue to be on Blue Jay Central with Jamie Campbell throughout this series. I'll be on with them briefly tonight as well. maybe taking a look at how Sal Perez is having a career year at 33. Pretty cool, although almost cost the Jays one yesterday. I thought maybe that Sal Perez is obviously not the fastest guy in the world, but Bobby Witt Jr. might be. And I thought for a second Bobby Witt Jr. might try to score from first on that single that Perez hooked down the left field line against Nate Pearson. And like Caleb said, it was actually a pretty well-executed pitch. Maybe you'd like the slider a little further down. It was on that kind of shadow zone on the outside part of the play. Perez did a nice job to take that down the left field line. And even the hit he gave up to Michael Garcia was a hard fastball in at the hands a little bit, a tough one to fight off there. So fun game for Nate Pearson. The Jays had to use a lot of the bullpen. If you miss it, Yariel Rodriguez went 3 2/3. The Royals were able to get to him. He kind of went away from his fastball. It's something I'd be interested to hear more about the why behind when I'm down at the park a little later. Only threw his fastball about 27% of the time in his first couple starts that had been up in the low 40s. So maybe that's a, hey, you're seeing the Royals a second time, you want to mix it up thing. Maybe he didn't like something about it, even though the velocity was there. Overall, that was, you know, his shakiest outing in terms of getting swing and miss, in terms of getting called strikes over. The Royals were on him pretty good. So he did go 3 2/3, gave up 3 earned, 6 hits, 3 walks, left 3 runners that Hennessy Cabrera then stranded. Cabrera then also had an excellent fifth inning, including striking out MJ Melendez following a 2-out single. Trevor Richards gave up a solo shot that cut into the league on a 92 mile an hour, kind of not quite meatball, but pretty meaty pitch to Kyle Isbell. Then Tim Mesa came through. Eric Swanson left a splitter up to Freddie Fermin for a home run, and then Nate Pearson closes it out. So that's a lot to ask of your bullpen in one day after Yariel Rodriguez only goes 3 2/3. It's a lot to ask when you don't have Bowden Francis in there as a long man, when the last guy in your bullpen who could maybe go multiple innings, Brendan Little, is not a guy who's in the trust tree yet to the level of a Bowden Francis or a Trevor Richards. So really nice job by the bullpen on a day that Jimmy Garcia and Jordan Romano weren't available, even if they did give up a couple runs to make that one tighter. This series will continue tonight at 7 o'clock. It's Jose Berríos against Cole Ragans, the rematch of the rainout game where they both got complete games for 5 innings of work and both looked pretty good. Be interested to see how they maybe change up their approach, how the opposing teams are on their best stuff. I'm going to talk on Blue Jay Central a little later, too, about some changes Jose Berríos has made to his pitch mix. Right now, though, we're going to take a break. On the other side, we'll talk to Mike Petriello of MLB.com, who was recently here in Toronto visiting us and doing a bunch of Blue Jays Central. Mike Petriello joins us as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Hey, it's Ailish Forafar.
And I'm Justin Cuthbert.
Join us as we discuss the most important sports stories of the day and tee up the biggest games of the night.
It's The Fan Pregame, 6 p.m. weekdays on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays win last night 6-5, ending their streak of 20 games in a row without scoring 6 runs. They went 10-10 during that streak, which I guess not bad for a streak where you can't score at all. But they're 11-1 when they score 5 or more, so they should do that more often. Could be tougher tonight with Cole Ragans on the hill against Jose Berríos. Series will wrap up tomorrow at 3 o'clock. A work-from-dome day with Chris Bassitt against Seth Lugo. We'll be joined now by Seth Lugo strikeout rate aficionado Mike Petriello of MLB.com. Mike, good morning. Thanks for doing this. How are you, buddy?
Hey, Blake. Always good to see you.
Yes, you can see me. I can hear you. I got to see you very recently. You were down in Toronto. You did a handful of Blue Jays Centrals live from Rogers Center. What'd you think of the new Rogers Center, both aesthetically and the fact that, you know, we got a season and a sixth year of kind of a pitcher-friendly ballpark so far?
Well, first of all, aesthetically, I enjoyed it greatly. I mean, you know, it's essentially a big concrete bowl in the middle of downtown, and there's only so much you can do with that. And I think they've really done a nice job. You know, I made sure to take a minute to walk up to the new party decks, really to the top of the stadium, just to look around. And I was really interested to see what they'd done. And it's cool, right? Like, I could totally imagine hanging out up there and seeing a game. And you're right that it does seem to be very pitcher friendly so far. I think it's maybe too soon to draw like complete conclusions, because it's not like the offense is crushing on the road either right now. But that does seem to be how it's playing. And it's really interesting. It's not what I expected.
Yeah, it's not. And we thought, you know, we didn't know. And the Jays are doing this us this nice favor of, okay, well, here was the old Rogers Center. And then we're going to change the dimensions. And then we're going to change the dimensions again before you can get the re. And, oh, by the way, the dome's open half the season as well. We're just never going to have good Rogers Center data, it seems like. But at least it's nice aesthetically and a nice place to watch a game. Now, you mentioned part of why maybe the offense is down is that the Jays' offense just hasn't been very good, and it's not playing on the road. It played a little better on the road last year, but still wasn't particularly effective. A little early, but given that we also saw this last year, do you get the sense we're kind of back to where we left off last year in terms of our discussions about the Blue Jays' offensive struggles?
Well, I think if you think about the offseason, this isn't exactly a surprise, right? Like, you think about the guys who left, some of the bigger bats like Matt Chapman, and then who did they bring in? You know, Kiermaier is a great defender, not exactly a huge bat. Connor Falefa, obviously a versatile defender, not a huge bat. So really, if the offense was going to improve, it was going to have to come from the guys who were there. They were going to have to get better. And, you know, that hasn't necessarily happened. So I don't think I'm shocked that they're performing, let's say, you know, below averagely from a slugging perspective, because it's essentially the lineup that was loaded up. You know, I did think we'd see more from Vlad Jr. I did think we'd see more from Bo Bichette. And it's funny, you can talk all you want about, like, what trades should we make? Should we call up guys from the minors? And it's important, right? You're not ever going to have a lineup that's driven just by two guys. But at the end of the day, you will play Bichette every day, and you will play Vlad Jr. every day. And either those guys will have great seasons or they won't. There's not a whole lot you can do about that, right? Like, you are not going to change streams from those guys. So there is a lot of pressure, I think, on each of them to perform a little bit more than they've done so far.
So one of the there is a lot of pressure, and it's something we've talked about a lot on this show in the early going here. Obviously, Vlad has been a big discussion point. Bo Bichette's numbers even lower, even though most around the team seem to have the sense that Bo's a little closer to being Bo and finding a hot streak here. His numbers have been even weaker than Vlad's so far, and he got a rare off day yesterday. Maybe surely a physical component to that, but maybe also a mental break as well. It does put the Jays in an interesting position where, like you said, they're not going to replace Bo, Vlad, Springer in the lineup particularly often, even if they changed up the batting order. You know, you can't slide your 1, 2, and 3 hitters all down at the same time, probably. But this does leave them in a position where some of the fringier lineup decisions day to day, they have to make an offense defense decision. They put Addison Barger in left field, a position that he'd never played at any level before in his major league debut. Davis Schneider has seen a little bit more time in left field even before the Kevin Kiermaier injury than maybe we expected. There's also Alejandro Kirk had a nice day Sunday, but they have to figure out the catcher playing time split between Jansen and Kirk when one of those guys has hit a lot better over the last year and change. If you are the Blue Jays in this position, are you at a point where you kind of have to lean toward the offensive side when you're making those split decisions on the lineup card?
Yeah, I think that's probably right, because the defense is not just good, it's tremendous. It's one of the best defenses in baseball. And I think that means that you've got enough good defenders where if you have to maybe go offense over defense at a spot or two, everyone else is good enough that you can get by, especially knowing that if you do get a lead, then you can just bring in a good defender, you know, in the late innings. Like, when I look at the lineup, I think I see, let's say, 5 spots where you should have a consistent starter every single day, sort of no matter how well they're performing or not, right? Vlad, Bichette, I would say Varsho is one of those guys. Turner, and I think this is going to be controversial, Davis Schneider has to be playing every single day for me until he proves otherwise. Everywhere else, you can kind of rotate. You know, you can bring up, let's say, Martinez from the minors and give him some run at second base, because you've got so many guys who can do so many different things, right? IKF is not a great hitter, but he's a good defender at multiple spots. You know, Schneider and Barger and Biggio can play multiple spots. You can mix and match. And I know people don't want to hear that Varsho should be one of those guys. And I know if Chris Black is listening, he'll be laughing that I'm saying Varsho should be one of those guys. He is, in my opinion, as good or maybe even better of an outfielder defensively than Kiermaier is right now. And I'm on record as saying Kiermaier is one of the 5 best outfielders to ever play the game defensively. That's how good I think Varsho is. And he's finally starting to hit. You know, he's got to be out there every single day. And you might notice I didn't say George Springer is one of those guys. And that's not a dig at Springer so much, just as it is. He's been around for, 10 years now. He's more, in my opinion, of a maybe complimentary piece on a good team than a main cog, the guy who keeps the engine going. So I feel like especially as he's aging a little bit, you know, you pick your right spots. No manager, no team today just does straight up platoons, lefties and righties. You know, it's about pitch shapes. Who's got a flat swing? Are we seeing a guy with a great rising fastball? Obviously, there's more information there than either of us have access to, and that'll help inform your decisions. But you really do need to get some of the bats going, and you need to find ways to get production that's not just waiting on Bichette and waiting on Guerrero, because there's seven other spots in the lineup every day. You got to get something out of those spots too.
Yeah, especially, you know, your pitchers as a team ERA haven't even done quite what you expect them to do over the long term, but they've kept you in an awful lot of ball games here. And yeah, you've got to be able to scrape a couple extra runs across. I think you'd actually be surprised in the early going here that you wouldn't get that much pushback on Dalton Varsho, in part because he's hitting much better, but also, you know, the offensive environment here for the Blue Jays has been so low that any hot hitter is going to have his supporters in the lineup every day, as Varsho should. On the catching side, the Jansen-Kirk split is interesting. Chris Black, who you just mentioned, had a thread out this morning at Down to Black on Twitter, going into some of Danny Jansen's power hitting stats, one of the best slugging percentages of any catcher over the last few years, and had an interesting note about Alejandro Kirk hitting a lot better after he's had a day off. Mike, how do you see that playing time split potentially playing out? Danny Jansen, again, over the last, you know, over the tenure that they've both been here, has out-hit Alejandro Kirk. And while Kirk is extremely good at framing the baseball relative to the entire league and relative to Danny Jansen, Danny Jansen is second in the entire league in StatCast's blocking metric. So you get some defensive juice with either guy.
Yeah, I think both of them, but I think especially Kirk, are maybe underrated in terms of how good defensively they are. And I know every time you talk about the Blue Jays catchers, somebody will start thinking about Gabriel Moreno, who I got to say, I think it's a little bit overrated. I think he's got the cannon of an arm, but I think he's a little bit overrated. So the one thing I think you got to take into account, and I don't have the answer for this, and maybe you do, is if there's any particular starting pitcher who like really, really prefers to throw to one or the other, or if I'm making this up because I don't know the answer. Let's say the way that Chris Bassitt throws his breaking balls makes it really more important for Kirk to be down there blocking, right? Like that's something that I think you do have to take into account, and I'm sure they do. But I think it's easier to have a plus defensive catcher who's maybe not hitting super well in Kirk when the rest of your offense is really going on all cylinders, right? That's a much easier lineup spot to carry. And that's not happening right now. Now, still, it's a catcher position. You're never going to have one guy going 9 times out of 10. It's just not the way it works. So it's like, what are we talking about here? Is it 50-50? Is it 60-40? Is it 2/3, 1/3, right? Like it's going to be an even split or even-ish no matter what you do, because both guys, you know, bring their valuable skills. But I think if you look at Danny Jansen's career, the number one issue that has prevented him from being like an outright star is just availability. It's sort of the repeated injury problems. That's not an issue right now. He's here. He's available. Let him play. Let him cook. Spot in Kirk where necessary until one or the other gets hot.
Yeah, and that's, you know, I think we're probably going to see that. And it's funny, the example you use, Bassitt-Kirk, is the one. So Bassitt's last start, he pitched to Dan Jansen. But generally, that is the one battery that they have tended to keep together when juggling these things. So we'll see how that shakes out moving forward. Good problem to have if they both get hitting a little bit here. Mike, want to zoom outside of Toronto and look league-wide a little bit. First, I don't know what the Jays fan appetite is for old Fenway Park stories, but you did a terrific piece at MLB.com this week telling the story and verifying this legendary story of the red seat home run at Fenway Park, a ball Ted Williams allegedly hit 502 to 535 feet, whatever the legend is. How did you go about verifying that? Yeah, Ted Williams probably hit that ball 500 feet to the red seat at Fenway Park.
Yeah, so it's marked as 502 feet. It's the red seat out there in deep right field. And earlier this month, Tristan Casas, who's a powerful left-handed hitter, crushed a ball out to right field that was like 430 or something like that. And he really stirred up the Boston media when he basically said, it's a myth. Like, I don't think that really happened. And so I thought to myself, well, that's pretty easy for me to go verify with like all our satellite mapping tools. And when I did that, I got 496 feet. And what I realized was that when they measured 502 feet, they were almost certainly measuring home plate to the impact point of the seat. And that's not really how home runs are measured anymore. We measure it all the way back to the ground. So when I put some math into that, I thought to myself, well, that's probably like 530 feet, which makes it an even taller tell. And then very fortunately for me, I realized that one of our wonderful data scientists, Clay Nunnally, had kind of presented on this at the Sabre Analytics Conference recently. So I hit him up and I said, hey, what if we adapt some of this research that you did that's awesome, and we put it into a story and we can kind of tell everybody that this story, which I know you're super passionate about. And he was all in and wonderful to work with. And so basically we were able to go back in time to 1946 and say, not only was it like a windy day, it was an insanely windy day, like boats capsized and people drowned. And there were stories of women giving birth under flashlights at hospitals that had lost power. And it's like, not to take away from Ted Williams, he was literally age 27, Ted Williams. I would believe anything you tell me that age 27 Ted Williams did. But between that and the wind and the fact that at that time Fenway Park was not as tall, they hadn't built like the press seating and all the clubs, and it was easier for him to access that wind, we were able to kind of show, not only is this real, we're probably underselling it. He probably hit it like 530 feet. And I don't think anybody could do that today, because you're not going to have the same confluence of wind, and Fenway Park is just different. So really, that, it hit my sweet spots of nerd data and looking up 78-year-old newspaper articles, which that's really where I shine, Blake.
Yeah, perfect. You also tweeted out a really good conversation between Ted Williams, Don Mattingly, and Wade Boggs from old Peter Gammon's piece in the Sports Illustrated Vault, which people can check out on your Twitter at @Mike_Petriello after this segment. Look, you have access to stuff like that. You also have access to newer StatCast things that, I can find my way to, but they're not quite as easy to find publicly yet, like bat speed and attack angle and things like that. These are newer StatCast things that we're just starting to figure out, that we only have last year and this year data-wise for. Have you had any early returns playing around with those kind of soon-to-come StatCast tools?
Well, I can tell you that in the month of May, we're going to launch a lot of the public leaderboards.
Nice.
So people will have the ability to play with a lot of it. I'm sorry to report you will not like where the Blue Jays' average bat speed is.
I'm aware.
As a team. Yeah, probably won't shock anybody, I guess, since the conversation we just had is they're not slugging. So it's going to be cool, and there's going to be a lot of metrics that will be available in, let's say, 2-ish weeks, which I think everybody will have a lot of fun with. It will just be starting in 2024, though. We won't be able to go back to past seasons just because that's testing data. And what you'll be able to do at first is, you know, bat speed. That's the obvious, right? Who swings the fastest and who doesn't? Giancarlo Stanton is still number one, mm-hmm. even after all these years. You'll be able to look at who squares up the ball the most, which I think is really interesting. You'll be able to look at who has the shortest swings and the longest swings. And I got to tell you, like, I always want this new data to inform me and teach me something. But when I looked up the shortest swings and longest swings, and I found that it was Luis Arraez on one end and Javier Baez on the other end, I was very pleased that it's actually telling me something that I think it should be. As far as like attack angle and stuff, that's going to be coming later this summer.
Okay.
There's a whole other, you know, bunch of metrics in the pipeline, but I think this is going to be really cool for people, because you think about how much of the game is decided at the batter's box, right? Strikeouts, contact. I'm not saying fielders don't matter. They do, but you know, the game is won and lost in the batter's box. And for years, we've been able to know a whole lot about what the pitcher is doing, where he's putting the ball, how he's moving the ball, how he's spinning the ball. We haven't really been able to tell you a lot about the batter side of that equation, other than did he make contact and did he hit it hard? And now we can tell you a lot about where the bat is, how it's moving. And I think that's really going to open up some really cool stories. We put the batter almost on the same level as the pitcher now.
Yeah, it should be a lot of fun. And yeah, I can go back and see 2023 data and say, you know, definitively based on those the data that we have, hey, George Springer's bat speed has slowed down. Eventually we'll have multi-years. We'll be able to track what that looks like. Tom Tango had a Twitter thread with the aging curves of bat speed and pitch velocity and things like that. So we can get a little bit of an understanding of when a guy declines, why that is, why some guys are able to, fight off that decline and things like that. So you said the game is won in the batter's box, pitcher versus batter for the most part. There is also, as we talked about a ton last year, an explosion of base stealing last year that is carried over for the most part to this year, but it is not uniform. You have a team, a 500 team like the Nationals, or a 16-13 team like the Reds, who have stolen a billion bases early on. Eli De La Cruz has 18 on his own. No other player has even attempted more than 14. The Nationals have that Lane Thomas, Jacob Young combo that are both in double-digit steals. And then you have a team like the Minnesota Twins, who are also above 500 and just never, ever steal. What are you seeing in the kind of league-wide base stealing environment? And I guess the way I am setting this up is, it really does feel like pace in basketball where you don't want to run just for the sake of running. It's a descriptor about style, not necessarily a good or bad thing on its own.
Yeah, I kind of expected we would see every team going nuts with base stealing this year, because last year was the first year with the new rules and the success rate was wild. You know, as I've said before, Trey Turner went 30 for 30 last year and everybody thought that was so cool. And I'm like, that's bad. That is not a good thing. If you are perfect, keep stealing. Like, you're leaving value on the bases. And it didn't really happen over the first couple of weeks. Base stealing was not, you know, the attempt rate was not markedly different from last year. And I think what's happening is you're seeing teams approach this very differently based on the personnel they have. Like, for example, you look at the Dodgers, right? And you have Mookie Betts leading off. And you say, yeah, Mookie Betts, great base stealer. Why isn't he stealing all the time? And then you're thinking to yourself, because Shohei Ohtani and Freddie Freeman are hitting behind him, and I want him on base. I do not want him to be thrown out. I don't care about the extra base. I don't want the risk of him being thrown out. And I think that's why you're seeing teams like the Nationals and Reds kind of, you know, really go nuts with the base stealing, in part because they can, like, they're good at it, they're successful. But they're not also, you know, top to bottom good offenses. They maybe need to make things happen more. I think especially for the Nationals, right? Like, they need to go out, find some interesting ways to win. Like, they're a young, fast team. Not every team has this. Like, if you look at the Twins, there's nobody on that team with great speed outside of maybe Byron Buxton. And we know he's been hurt so much over the years. You don't necessarily want to risk it. So in some way, you got to go with the roster you have as opposed to the roster you might want to have. But I think we're sort of settling into a sweet spot here where teams are figuring out the new rules. Here's how much we can steal. Here's how much we should steal. And I think a lot of credit has to go to pitchers and catchers for figuring out how to work within the new rules, for not being totally abused, for doing a really good job of preventing teams from going wild.
Okay, so we've only got about 2 minutes left with you here, Mike. And anytime we're talking stats, anytime we're talking MLB.com, our pal Sarah Langs is front of mind. It's also her birthday week, which we know is a big thing for her. You guys got anything going at those MLB offices for Sarah this week or anything? Or you want to give her a little happy birthday here?
Yeah, if you don't know Sarah's story, she's battling ALS, and she's been pretty open and brave about this for the last couple of years. And she means an incredible amount, not only to us who work with her personally, but anybody who follows baseball, I think, has heard her story, knows her name, knows how much she loves the sport, how much she means. And her birthday is on Thursday. And even before any of this, even before she got sick, birthdays were such a huge deal to her. She loved to talk about players' birthdays. It was like the biggest thing was birthdays for her. And obviously, as we try to find ways to celebrate her in any way we can, when it's her birthday, that is the biggest deal. So birthday week almost feels too short. It's like every day is Sarah's birthday, really. So on Thursday, this upcoming Thursday, make sure to tweet at her, text her, email her, in any way you have to contact her. Make sure you know that you're thinking about her on her birthday and express how much we all love and respect her.
Yeah, Sarah, friend of the show. She's been on with us before, came on with us on Lou Gehrig Day last year, where all around baseball, people were speaking as kindly about Sarah as we all should every day. Mike Petriello, thank you for that message. Thanks for taking the time out this morning, buddy.
Thanks a lot, Blake. See you soon.
Mike Petriello of MLB.com and of Subway Ghosts. That's his band. We're going to have Dan Epstein of Baseball Prospectus on sometime in the next couple weeks, too. He's been writing a series on the revolution of the splitter. He's the drummer in that band as well. So you've got some sports stats guys in a New York band. One day we'll have to play their music on the show. We don't have a show tomorrow, just as a little procedural note, because it's a 3 p.m. start and because the Toronto Maple Leafs are in a pretty big game tonight. The schedule is getting a little juggled tomorrow. So no Jays Talk Plus tomorrow, but we will return Thursday and Friday as usual, 11 to 12. Blair and Barker will still be on with you. They'll be on with you today, 2 to 4, and for Jays Talk postgame as well. A little reminder, because I did get a couple questions about it yesterday during the game. Dan Schulman is off this series, as is Buck. So as is Hazel, actually. So it's a rest series all around, Bo Bichette too. So it is Ben Schulman, Joe Siddle, and Arden Zwelling that you're hearing on the TV side. It is Eric Smith and Chris LaRue that you're hearing on the radio side. It is Jamie Campbell and Caleb Joseph with a little assist from me tonight on Blue Jays Central as well. Jose Berríos against Cole Ragans. Jose Berríos has mixed up his pitch usage the last couple of starts in a way that I'm hoping to get a closer look at tonight, talk about it a little bit pregame on Blue Jays Central, going really heavy on the sinker slurve, minimizing the changeup and the four-seam usage a little bit, and he's introduced a cutter. So he's a little all over the place. Cole Ragans, you know what to expect. It's heavy on that 96-mile-an-hour fastball from the left side, a 95th percentile fastball run value so far this year, and big whiff on his changeup and that knuckle curve. We'll see if the Jays can do a little better with it the second time they see it in a week. It is Jose Berríos. It is Cole Ragans. It's 7 o'clock down at Rogers Center. Thanks to Caleb Joseph and Mike Petriello for coming on. Thanks to Amit Mann, my producer. Thanks to Lance Kennedy and Jennifer Rolnick behind the glass. We will talk to you on Thursday at 11 a.m. Have a great day.